You're listening to The Back 40, the podcast for Ontario farmers, covering topics and issues that matter most to Ontario agriculture. Brought to you by Trillium Mutual Insurance, bringing the ag community together one podcast at a time. I'm the host of The Back 40, Mike Brine, agribusiness specialist at Trillium Mutual Insurance. Recently, there's been a lot in the news about the migrant farm population and a realization by the public in Canada that we rely very heavily on foreign labor for the harvesting of our fruits and vegetables in particular. It's something that really came to light with the pandemic. There were issues getting our migrant workers here and keeping them safe after they were here. Today, I'm talking with Jen Fenning from Fenning's Organic Vegetables. We're going to be talking about some of the issues surrounding the migrant workers. Jen, welcome to the Back 40.
Thanks for having me.
So Jen, you're one of the owners of Fenning Organic Vegetables. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your farm?
Well, I share an office with my husband together with his brother and sister-in-law. The four of us own Fenning's Organic Vegetables. We farm about 700 acres just outside New Hamburg. The family's been farming in this area since 1981, when my in-laws came over from Germany. The Fenning family has been farming for at least 400 years, according to our records, you know, so that really runs deep. And I married into the family. My own agricultural roots are from early childhood as well. My father has a PhD in horticulture, so I grew up in greenhouses and fields and on tractors and have always had a love of growing things and farming and everything to do with food.
So it was a natural fit when you came into the Fenning farm there. It's something that was very much within your experience.
Absolutely. You know, when I was a kid, I actually wanted to grow up and marry a farmer. So lo and behold, here I am.
Well, we're glad to have you with us today. You employ quite a few migrant workers, and they're a very important part of your labor force in order to get your crops both planted and harvested, aren't they?
Absolutely. So, you know, in 1981, the farm was mostly grains, and they only started a few rows of vegetables in the first few years. But it's grown now to where we are growing almost 100% of our acreage in vegetables, depending on rotation. We're an organic farm, so that rotation is very much part of our farming practice. The most of the acreage is in vegetables, and that requires a lot of labor. We had been hiring locals for seasonal work since the mid-90s, but in 2005, we just couldn't find enough people to reasonably do all the work that we had to do. And we started employing temporary foreign workers on the seasonal agricultural worker program from Jamaica. A number of those men are still with us and have been coming every year since. They have been like family to us. We have very strong connections with them. My husband and I have been to Jamaica and visited their families many times. When you share so much of your life, you naturally develop bonds and close relationships. And we really couldn't do what we do without them.
It's a very important relationship for both sides of that. It's, as you say, you can't get away without having that type of labor, and it really does benefit them as well.
It certainly does. It's a really complex thing. When I talk about the men that come here every year, they're leaving families behind. They're not coming to Canada because it's a fun way to travel. They're coming because they don't have economic opportunities at home that allow them to put their kids through school, provide adequate food and clothing and all of the things that we all want to provide for our children and to prepare the next generation for a successful life. So they're coming here because they simply do not have those opportunities at home. So they're making a sacrifice, raising their children to come here and work on farms so that they can provide to their children what they wouldn't otherwise be able to. And to me, that's something that we really need to focus on when we're talking about why they come every year. Because a lot of times when people look at them coming back year after year, they think that must mean that everything's great, everything's wonderful here, and they enjoy it and they're happy. And sure, most of them are happy in a lot of ways. But how would any of us feel having to leave our families for 8 months or 2 years or whatever length of contract they have, depending on the program they're on? And you find ways to be happy and do what you have to do, but it's very challenging for them at the same time.
And a lot of these workers that come into Canada through this program, they do come to farms such as yourselves, where they're well looked after and treated in many ways as an extension of your own family. But recently, we've heard that there are some issues with some of the farms and some of the places that these migrant workers have been working for.
And there absolutely are. I mean, the statistics are there, the data is there, the stories are out there. You know, you don't have to look far. For me, I prefer not to focus so much on the individual farm or the individual person within the system, but we need to look at it from a systems perspective. The positive experience or negative experience is predicated entirely on the random whim or goodwill of the employer. When you look at employment, generally, there's a power imbalance between any employer and employee. It's inherent in the relationship. There's a lot of work that's been done to regulate that relationship, to remove the imbalance as much as possible and to protect workers. And some employers feel like they don't have enough. But the reality is that there is still a power imbalance, and that's with every employer and employee. Then you add in migrant workers are reliant on their employer for transportation, housing, and their actual status in the country, because farm workers are tied to one employer. If they're not happy, they can't say, I don't like the conditions here, I'm going to find another job. They get put on a plane and sent back home, and then they don't have that income to provide for their family. And again, you know, we look at what their opportunities are back home. You really have a very strong motivator for people to put up with things that they wouldn't otherwise put up with. So we have a system that strengthens that inequality.
That gets back to that sacrifice that you talked about that they do make. As you say, they're reliant on their employer for virtually everything once they get here. So from the standpoint of Canada then, why do we bother with migrant workers? Why don't we just employ our own people, our own Canadians in the industry? Certainly with COVID, we've seen a higher incidence of unemployment. Wouldn't that make more sense to just employ Canadians?
I wish that was an actual solution. If we look at each person, we have to look at our own lives. What do we want out of life? We all want a job that we feel good about. We all want our neighbors and family to respect us. We want to earn enough money to have a reasonably comfortable life and provide for our loved ones. We have, as a society, decided that we don't value work that is physical. We don't value the kind of labor that it takes to actually grow food, to feed ourselves. The skill set that it takes to harvest broccoli is huge. Most people have no idea why that is. And broccoli is my favorite example about skills. A broccoli field being harvested inappropriately, so being cut too early or left too long, can literally make or break that few seconds that a worker has to decide whether or not to cut that head. Can cut your profit, cut your yield in half for the entire crop. Because broccoli, if you look at it, you sometimes have three heads in a bunch, you sometimes have two, sometimes you have one head that is big enough to be a bunch all by itself. Well, the same plant produces all of those heads, the same acreage in a field, the same footprint produces one head. And whether it is a head that's big enough to be a bunch by itself or it's, you know, has to be bunched with two or three others. And you have to be able to decide, is this head going to be able to grow a little bit more? Or do I need to cut it now? Because by the time I come back in 2 days, it's going to be too far gone. And you have a few seconds, if that, to determine that as you walk through the field behind the harvest aid. That skill set, it takes years. We don't value that kind of skill in our society generally. So young people are not raised to think of farming as an economically viable activity. So they don't choose it as careers. I've had Canadian workers have their family ask them when they're going to get a real job. As much as we respect farmers as a society, I mean, you look at all the polls, it says that farmers are either the most trusted or, you know, among the top two or three most trusted professions in our society. But we don't want to do that work ourselves. And when it comes to actually doing the labor of planting and harvesting and tending to all of the food crops, we don't value that either economically or societally. And I know that's a really hard thing to look at ourselves and go, whoa, what's wrong with our value set? But that's the situation that we have that has created this lack of availability of labor within the country.
My father said this many times, the problem is in this country, we've never been hungry. We all enjoy a very high standard of living. Our typical amount that we spend on food is in the neighborhood of 10% or lower. And we often think we pay too much for food. And I've said that mostly that's because of our perception, because the cheapest food in the world is just to the south of our border. The US typically has a lower cost than what we have. And we think that somehow we're being ripped off. And yet very many places in the world pay far more for their food than what we do. That all plays into what we end up paying for that labor in order to harvest that crop and how we value those skills, doesn't it?
It does. And there's no one thing. If you like, it's a whole tapestry. One thread connects to another thread, connects to another thread. There are so many different things that have come together to create the situation that we have today. And one of those threads is the temporary foreign worker program, and specifically the seasonal agricultural worker program. It began in the 50s as a response to a lack of compliant workforce. So agriculture in the 50s was experiencing a serious deficit in available able-bodied people to perform the labor on farms. And the seasonal agricultural worker program was born. The rest of the temporary foreign worker program is much newer. And I don't have a date on exactly when that began, but the seasonal agricultural worker program has been in existence for about 53 years. And if you think about the conditions that are set up by the regulations that govern that program, it's something that I've really spent a lot of time thinking about in the last few years, about how that has impacted the development of the labor market within agriculture. While this program is much more widespread than a lot of people realize, it still is not as widespread as all of agriculture. You know, there are certain sectors of agriculture where it is very rare. Vegetable production and fruit production is where it's most commonly used, but animal husbandry and dairy specifically do use some workers under the temporary foreign worker program as well. But if you think about the seasonal agricultural worker program, the workers are here for a maximum of 8 months. The employer must provide transportation to and from the country. They must provide transportation within the country and an accommodation of some kind. There is no national standard on housing as yet, but there is a proposed one. The standard for bunkhouses across the country varies. It also varies by sector. So when you have that, and then you have the regulation of wages within that program, the wages in the seasonal agricultural worker program are set. Negotiation between the countries of origin of the workers and representatives from the Canadian government and industry broadly. They are typically at around minimum wage. They didn't used to be tied to minimum wage. They didn't used to receive at the minimum wage at the beginning, but there were broader exemptions back then as well. Currently, it is either at minimum wage or just slightly above. So last year, at the beginning of the season, minimum wage was $14 an hour, and the seasonal agricultural worker program required, I believe it was $14.15. In Ontario, of course, it's different across the country, province by province, depending on the minimum wage. And in fact, each country has slight variations in the negotiated contract. But that contract is common to all workers who enter the country. Outside of the seasonal agricultural worker program, you also have the ag stream, which very problematically is referred to as low-skilled stream. In that, you can pay above minimum wage. And there, in the last few years, they've really started looking at comparable jobs and requiring a wage that is comparable to the average in the NOC code. All of these technicalities are really important when we're talking about how it has impacted the evolution of labor and the labor market in agriculture.
So our migrant workers are paid minimum wage or slightly above minimum wage, but that's not the entire cost to the farmer. There's a lot of other costs that are associated with that as well.
That's absolutely true. In addition to the hourly wage, we provide housing and transportation. The average Canadian worker, if they're paid minimum wage, has to still provide themselves with a transportation method, whatever that may be, and housing. Those workers do cost us more than minimum wage, but they're worth it, and then some. So when you have a workforce that is kept compliant by the pressures that they're under, which we talked about, you know, the lack of opportunity at home, the control of every aspect of their life here by the employer, and then you have a regulated wage that is not individualized and has minimal opportunity to see advancement for a worker, where they can continue making minimum wage for 10 years, 15 years, their entire career without ever being paid more than minimum wage. Just think about that for a moment. And how would that impact, take away every other aspect that you think about with the temporary farm worker program and farming? How would that impact a labor market? You can't avoid the conclusion that that has artificially depressed wages within the agricultural sector broadly.
And that makes a huge difference as to whether or not we bring in migrant workers or whether we pay Canadians that are already here for that. It's really hard to justify paying a living wage to someone who lives here when you can bring in a migrant worker for just above minimum wage.
And not only that cost, but also the compliance. So, you know, if a migrant worker is unhappy, they're very likely to put up with it. That is one of the things that bothers me most as an employer, the notion that I can't truly know whether the men who are working beside me are honestly, deeply happy and satisfied, because no matter how nice I am, no matter how respectful I am, no matter how much I treat them well, the reality remains and they live under the threat of repatriation without cause. I can't do enough as an individual farmer, as an individual employer, to offset that imbalance. I can't.
So when a worker comes into this country, they're tied to a specific farm. They come in to work for a specific farm. Why don't we just open it up so that it's like Canadians would face right here, where, yes, we're more or less tied to our jobs, but there's an open market there. If somebody's unhappy with the place that they're working, why couldn't they just come and talk to you and say, Jen, hire me, I need a job, and maybe you're getting behind on the work, you could use the extra labor. Why not put in place something like that?
Well, there are a couple reasons. The biggest reason that as the program stands today isn't feasible. They've begun to do that. So if a worker right now is unhappy, there is a provision for them to be able to leave. There's a lot of paperwork, but there is a process. I've had this where a worker contacted me and said, I'm really unhappy. I want to leave. My employer is going to let me leave. We can change. And that process can be initiated. Well, I have to have an empty bed for them to sleep in. I have to have what's called a labor market impact assessment that allows me to hire the workers. So for each worker that an employer brings in, they have to have gone through a process of advertising for the position and proving that they couldn't get a Canadian to fill a job. They have to prove that they have adequate and appropriate housing, and then you can apply to have the worker. That's a lot of work to put that kind of a paperwork package together, and time. So I go through that, and you better believe I fill every single one of the positions that I am approved for. I don't have an empty bed. So this worker now, where are they going to go? They can't go work at McDonald's. They can't go work at Tim Hortons. They can't go work at the local gas station or grocery store or any other job where the average Canadian might go to find a new job if they just wanted to get out of where they were. And they also have nowhere to live, because as the employer, if my employee leaves, I don't want them living in my bunkhouse anymore. Aside from whatever relationship or issues there might be with the relationship on the farm or working conditions on the farm, it's practically impossible for them to leave. There's theory and then there's reality. And in theory, they have all the same rights that you and I do on paper. They're supposed to be treated fairly. They're supposed to not be discriminated against. They are not allowed to be paid less than minimum wage. They're not supposed to be forced to work 7 days a week. They're supposed to be given adequate breaks and rest periods. But how do you avail yourself of your rights when you can't walk away?
That's the ultimate expression there, is if something is really bad, you always have that threat that you can walk away and go get another job. Without that as a practical option, it may be a legal option, but without that as a practical option, you really are tied to that one spot.
you know, we see that across all kinds of populations where there are power imbalances. And when we're talking about domestic violence, why do a lot of women not leave? Because they don't have anywhere else to go, or they're afraid they can't take their children with them or their pet. There are all kinds of reasons why human beings choose to stay. It's not a real choice, but people view it as a choice. A really great concept that helped me define this for myself came from a woman I know who's been just a phenomenal powerhouse in advocating for workers who've been trafficked, Tania Nagy. She's written a book. She was talking about her experiences having been trafficked. And she said, a choice is when you have two or more options of similar value. So whether we're talking about the choice to come to Canada and put up with less than ideal working conditions or even very unpleasant working conditions versus staying at home in Jamaica and not being able to afford to send your children to school. Is that a choice? That really is the crux of the matter. And that's what creates this structural vulnerability.
Do you like what you're hearing from the Back 40? We'd like to hear from you. Send us an email with your comments and thoughts to theback40@trilliummutual.com or follow us on social media at Trillium Mutual. So over the last year, we've really seen the migrant worker issue come into light, and not in a necessarily in a positive way. And it started with the issues of how do we get our migrant workers into the country because of quarantine issues and because of lack of flights and all sorts of problems that we have in getting them in here. Did you get your workers in on time, and how did you cope with that?
We were fortunate in our misfortune. For us, it definitely had an impact on our season, but not anywhere near the impact that it had on the strawberry or asparagus growers. And I believe some of the apple growers and orchards, because of the timing of when they need the workers to arrive and the impact to their early season. And I know it was in the news, right, that asparagus growers, there were hundreds of acres lost because there was no one to harvest them. Our workers normally arrive between about April 15th and roughly the end of May. And last year, the first workers didn't begin working until late June, once quarantine was over. The last person to arrive and be ready to work began work on around August 20th. We've never had people arrive that late, but between lack of flights, the absolute chaos in the paperwork, what happened was when everything shut down, they recalled all the Canadians from the embassies. And so processing on all of the visas and everything stopped dead. All the paper was just left, doors were locked, and everybody walked away. And then when it was opened back up again and said that, you know, we're going to start processing, and they came up with a system, and they, as you might imagine, that was pretty chaotic. So there were missing documents and things had to be redone. You know, the workers within that system really came through, and it was difficult for them.
So is it better this year, or do you still face some of the same challenges, or are there different challenges?
Slightly different challenges, some of the same things. So last year, because the flights were sort of hodgepodge and with the paperwork mess, we couldn't bring them when we wanted to bring them. But this year, there are no flights at all until May 1st. So I'm really, really hoping that nothing happens to further delay that. At this point, I have tentatively booked 34 flights for May 1st. And we will be hoping to bring a further 12, which are 12 new workers, on June 5th. And that's arrival in the country. That means that they won't be able to begin work until the middle of May because of the two-week quarantine. Additionally, for them, they have to have a negative COVID test before their flight within, I believe it's 72 hours of the flight. Arrive in Canada, where they will be tested again. Unlike people who are traveling for leisure, they will be released to the farms immediately because they're going to a supervised quarantine location. So they will be released to us. And that's why we're bringing all 34 men together on one day so that they can all quarantine in their own beds, in their own rooms, with their own stuff. Because these are guys who've been coming to us for years, so they have their homes here. and I will provide them with food. I'll go shopping every day and do a wellness check on them. That's the same as last year, for 14 days, track their temperature and any reported symptoms, which we were incredibly, incredibly lucky, and we didn't have any symptoms or any cases last year. I don't want to tempt fate, so we'll just leave that little piece right there and move on and not talk about that. The new situation also with the vaccine, I'm really hoping that we can have a mobile clinic for the workers on the farm. I intend to address that with the provincial government and regional people in charge of it.
So once you get your workers here and they've come through the 14-day quarantine and they're ready to be able to work on the farm, how do you keep them safe after they're here?
The protocols that we have for our migrant workers are exactly the same as we have for everyone else. You know, last year when the pandemic hit and at the beginning, nobody really knew what protocols we were supposed to implement. Personally, that was my full-time job for several months, was just writing protocols, reading, finding out what the newest public health information was, learning about other companies' mistakes and experiences so that I could apply that to what we were doing. We implemented as much cohorting as possible. We locked the doors of the facility. No one's allowed in the building that doesn't have to be there for work. From the office, I don't go into the warehouse. Normally, you know, we're like family. We're always having meals together. We have coffee break together and we enjoy spending time together. You know, it just makes work so much more enjoyable to be able to interact socially. Unfortunately, with, you know, wanting to keep COVID out or mitigate the spread, if it did happen to impact one of our workers, we had to enforce these rules. And so, you know, the truck drivers that work doing deliveries, they don't come in the building anymore. And again, various teams just don't cross each other's space boundaries. Then outside of work, we simply asked everyone to follow public health guidelines. Public health guidelines were, don't have people over in your house. If you're going to spend time with friends and family, do it outside. Stay at a distance. We provided PPE. Again, you know, I try to research all of the data that I can. And from the beginning, they said that cotton was the best fabric for masks. I found a supplier just outside Toronto that was making organic cotton triple layer masks that actually have a rating. So they've been, the fabric has undergone testing to determine that it does actually filter. So I sourced those and deployed them to all of our team. One of the mistakes, I think, that's been made by some of the farms that I know of from workers on those farms is that they deployed PPE for when the workers were on the production lines or at work. And at the end of the shift, they collected the PPE back from the workers. So now they have no mask to go shopping and they have no masks to be able to go anywhere else or engage in all of the things that, you know, you need to do for your life. And I think that created another vulnerability for us. You know, from day one, the masks are reusable, washable, wash them, wear them, use them to protect yourself when you're out in the community and protect each other. And obviously masks not being to protect yourself, but protect everyone else from you, right? Yeah, hand sanitizer. We provided bleach and hand sanitizer and other cleaning products just to, you know, make sure that they had what they needed. We also implemented a cleaning checklist within the bunkhouse, and one of the team leads within each bunkhouse took the responsibility to ensure that all of the touch surfaces were being wiped down with bleach at least once a day. And public health then recommended twice a day, so we increased it. We talked a lot with our public health unit. Bunkhouses in Ontario are inspected by public health. In order to have a positive LMIA to be able to hire these workers every year, you have to have a bunkhouse inspection that covers everything from the distance between the beds to how many toilets and sinks and whether the water is potable, et cetera, and whether you have enough dishes and bedding and all of those things for the workers. That is a great resource. And I went, okay, they're coming to the bunkhouse to inspect. I'm going to pick their brain for everything COVID. And so we implemented carpooling policy as well, because that was identified as a source of transmission for some of the outbreaks. We deployed thermometers to all of our drivers so that when they're driving, you know, they check everybody's temperature and ask them about symptoms before they enter the vehicle. While they're in the vehicle, everyone's wearing a mask. Everyone is sanitizing their hands on entry to the vehicle. And after the exiting the vehicle, the driver is responsible to ensure that the touch surfaces are wiped down with disinfectant.
A lot of things that we never thought we'd ever have to do, we all of a sudden, well, I mean, we've all had to make those changes in our own lives. But when you start talking about keeping workers safe, and it's not a typical situation where the workers arrive at your door and you're responsible to keep them safe while they're at work, you have a situation where it's a 24/7 because you're also providing housing for them as well. Now, we've heard a lot about some of the outbreaks and some of the issues that people have run into with the design, the original design of their bunkhouses. And I've heard of people that have had larger bunkhouses that have had only allowed three people in a very large room there. From your situation, though, that you're a little different in that your bunkhouses are set up with more individual rooms, aren't they?
The largest, we have one room that has three bunk beds, six total beds. They're situated so that the room is an L shape. So one of the bunk beds is in one part of the L and one is in the middle and one is at the other end. So they are more than 6 feet apart. But in addition to having their heads, you know, 6 feet apart from each other, I also went to the secondhand shop and got cotton sheets. And we hung curtain rod from the ceiling and hung the sheet so that it creates just a little bit more of a barrier, and bought enough of the sheets that the workers can change them and wash them daily. But we have, yeah, one room that has six beds in it and one room that has four, and the rest are either two or one. My ideal would be to have them all have private rooms. Brought that up with one of the guys who lives in the four-bedroom room, and he said, don't do that. I like having my guys with me. You know, we lay in bed at night and we talk about the day and philosophize. They happen to really like their roommates and enjoy spending time together. It's not always the case, unfortunately. So, you know, having smaller rooms definitely creates a break if a case were to come into the team. In the larger bunkhouses where we're talking about 40 beds in a dormitory style room, I don't understand how, but I have seen video evidence and firsthand accounts from workers saying that some of those rooms, they literally have one or two toilets and showers between them shared. So when you're talking about that large of a space with 2 or 3 feet between the bunk beds, if that, I don't understand, given the requirements from public health, I don't understand how those bunkhouses have passed inspection.
It's only that now we're going through a pandemic that a lot of this has come to light. And a lot of this now has become an issue that has reached mainstream media. And the issue has died down maybe over the last few months. But as we start seeing the migrant workers arrive again, it's going to come back again. And it's going to be mainstream. There's a lot of different problems that you've outlined here. Some of them are very much inherent with the very work that they have to do, but others are solvable. What do you think the solutions are to some of these problems?
In 2005, we started using the program. I really didn't know enough about it or how the regulations really impacted everyone. Within a year, I started realizing there were problems, and my first ideas were we need better enforcement of the rules, more inspections, audits, etc. A few years ago, they did start auditing, but almost all of the changes that have been implemented are paperwork changes, and most of them have increased the paperwork burden for farmers and have done nothing to improve the treatment of workers. It's not the first time I've said it. And I'm not saying it to blame or shame or create division, but we have to be real about what the problems are if we want to have any hope of fixing even one of them. The reality is that we can't fix the program by tinkering with pieces of it. And that doesn't mean that the current process to implement a national standard for housing is bad. I'm fully in support of it. I've advocated for some of the changes that are being implemented. I've been in support of that process. because we have to do what we can with the system we have while we still have the system, but it's not enough. What we need to do is fully reimagine and rewrite everything about how we bring people, their workers second, their people first. So we have to reimagine how people are entering our country to do work that is absolutely essential to providing food that we grow here. And when we look at it through that lens, and you look at the program the way it's written, we have to completely change everything about it from the ground up. When we think about them as human beings who have wishes and desires and needs for companionship and love and family and children, and we look at the negative impact that taking parents away from their children for so much of their lives has on the countries that they come from. You know, we talk about the issues here. I could spend a whole other podcast talking about the negative impacts to communities in these areas where so many of the adults are leaving to find employment elsewhere. But if we look at it from the Canadian lens, if we truly believe that we are a country that values people and treats people fairly, then we should allow these people to bring their families and fully partake in Canadian life. Their children should be allowed to go to our schools. Their families should be allowed to share this community. I think we have some really phenomenal communities in Canada. I really love my community, and I would be happy to share it with each and every one of my workers on a permanent basis with their families. I would be delighted to see their children offered the opportunities that my children were offered. I grew up being told by my father, don't ever judge somebody for what they may have in life or what opportunities. You didn't do anything special to be born to this family in this country with all of the privileges that you were born with. You didn't do anything special. It was a luck of your birth. And that is really a foundational principle for me in how I view the world. We are fortunate. We're privileged. That doesn't mean I've never suffered. But there are a lot of ways that I have been privileged. And we need to not just continue with that. We need to make sure that we are extending that privilege to people who are absolutely vital to maintaining the privilege we have.
That would be a fundamental change that would really change both the labor market, the migrant workers, whatever the legislation would be that allows them into the country to work. That would be a fundamental change to how we do business, wouldn't it?
It would. But wouldn't that be wonderful?
Well, I think it would be. I think that that would put it in a very different light as to how we are getting our food and the value that we would have to place on that labor that comes in that does that work. You no longer look at these as low-skilled jobs, as you indicated that many people consider them to be, but you would have to consider those to be a higher skilled labor position, and they would need to be paid to that. And that sooner or later, that has to go someplace other than just to the farmer. That's also going to end up that everybody in the grocery store pays a little bit more. It's for a really good reason. Yeah. So that we're not producing our food on the backs of somebody else, but we're paying them and compensating them correctly for that work.
You know, for me, this has profound impacts for how we view society and how we value people in our society widely. I spent 7 years on the board of directors of FoodShare Toronto. And I don't know if you're familiar with that organization, but they do some really fantastic work with food access, especially in downtown Toronto. And, you know, their focus is 4 and 6. It was a really richly rewarding experience as well. FoodShare is about food access and food justice. While we're talking about migrant workers and labor justice in our food system, we also have to look at food access. When we talk about anything that's going to increase the price of food, and you're looking at a population that's already having a hard time accessing healthy food, we have a whole other set of things that we need to address as well. But I think that it's the start, and that foundational change could revolutionize our society.
When you go to fix one problem, it always has consequences somewhere else, doesn't it? I suspect that could be a whole different podcast that we could have in a different conversation. Jen, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. It has been wonderful to speak to you today. We're talking with Jen Fenning from Fenning's Organic Vegetables about the migrant worker issues that have been brought to light throughout our pandemic.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Back 40. Join us next time when our guest is Russ Barker from Better Crops by Barker.
You've been listening to The Back 40, brought to you by Trillium Mutual Insurance. Be sure to subscribe to The Back 40 wherever you find your favorite podcasts so that you don't miss an episode. The Back 40, bringing the ag community together one podcast at a time. I'm Mike Brine. Until next time, take care and stay safe.